are listening to Waiting on Reparations, a production of iHeartRadio.
Alright, yo, alright, this is how we'll do things. COVID got a new strain, Musk got the duffel bag loot, sorta like 2 Chainz, it'll make your mood change. Billionaires are placing bets, gamble with the system, got everybody placed in debt. Vote against your interests, get a grave regret. Now they're going after Omar and they making threats, that's a no-no. We can't forget Chris Cuomo, helping his brother out pro bono. So understand, when you see in my face, it's like the treble on the speaker, see it vibrate. When it comes to rhymes, motherfuckers seeing I'm great, make white boys say, why I gotta be about race? Hey,
hey,
what is happening?
What's popping, my good people?
What up? My name's Dope Knife.
I'm Lingua Franca.
And we are waiting on reparations.
Hurry up.
We are back. Had to take a little load off for Thanksgiving. How was your Thanksgiving? Happy Thanksgiving, by the way.
Happy Thanksgiving. Happy belated Thanksgiving. It was good. It was restful. I went up to my aunt's house. My family lives on this like compound in the middle of nowhere, North Carolina. Like, at my auntie's house. My other auntie lives on the other side of my grandma. My other auntie and cousin live right down the street. And so went out there, held some babies. Got very full and very high. And it was interesting to me. This is the first, these are the first years in which I'm reflecting on how fucked up of a holiday Thanksgiving is. Mm-hmm. And like deep, you know, deeply and gaining awareness about like the new observance of the National Day of Mourning for Indigenous folks on that day. And my family is actually Afro-Indigenous. I've known my whole life, but have not really like researched or at all attempted to learn about our customs or heritage or history. And so with the passage of Indigenous Peoples Day as the first Monday in October, I guess, you know, Columbus Day, earlier this year, I started thinking about just like Indigenous life ways and knowledge and how that can be incorporated into, you know, policymaking, but also just like, what does it mean to try to recover your lost heritage that it was been erased? And so I spent some time on Wikipedia, just reading about our tribe, the Halawasaponi tribe, that my family still lives on like the tribal lands.
Oh, snap.
And yeah, I learned a lot of interesting history. For example, under Jim Crow, Indigenous people were treated the same as Black people, disenfranchised from voting, harassed and terrorized in all these ways. There was this resistance for the Indigenous folks. They wanted, I guess we wanted our own schools. We wanted separate stuff from Black people because we didn't want to get lumped in with Black people because Black people were treated like shit. But even down to like the birth certificate records and things like that, in this area, like you were either Black or white. They didn't even have like a checkbox for if you were Native American. And so like all these ways that, you know, I just assumed I grew up and they just didn't teach me my history. But before that, there's like very systematic erasure of all of our past. Like you couldn't even, you couldn't even check the box to say I am a Native American on a lot of official documents, which is partially why, you know, I grew up thinking myself Black, and I am Black. I'm very Black, proud of my Black heritage. But like, you know, the Indian shit got like just totally bulldozed and steamrolled generations before I even came along. So anyway, that was a day of reflection on all that stuff for me. And I'm looking forward to seeing where, I don't know, what my studies and like reflection on that take me policy-wise, like, and just like personally.
It's like peeling back an onion way.
Yeah. Turning it all over, all the stones.
You know, it's like I'm not quite sure what the like just regular Liberian like holiday or festivity is, or even if it even is a holiday. It's just Thanksgiving's always been something that we've celebrated, mm-hmm. but never really like we never really paid any emphasis to like the I guess story of Thanksgiving. It's always just been kind of an excuse. And in my household, it was always
right. It's an excuse
for family to get together.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
And to give thanks and to do all that sort of thing. But I don't know, the whole, you know, pilgrims and Indians and the turkey, and it was less of an important thing less of a thing when I was growing up.
Yeah.
And then I do remember, like, you know, being a kid, in the Ice-T albums, there were a couple Ice-T albums where he makes like an explicit reference to Thanksgiving and how he doesn't celebrate it because black people were in chains when they created it and shit. And that always stuck with me in the back of my head when I was a kid and just growing up. So like, I just always had that sort of feeling that there's something wasn't right about Thanksgiving. So that by the time I got old enough to, you know, learn the things, it wasn't really like a shock to me. It was more like, yeah, I knew this holiday was some bullshit.
Yeah, but
turkey was good though.
Yeah, speaking of like shocking things, in sort of considering what like return to like Native American stewardship or like incorporation of their practices and like knowledges into governance looks like, I've been learning a lot about the people who used to live in the lands that we now call Athens, Georgia, where I live.
Oh, word.
And it turns out that the Muscogee Creek people, who have since relocated to Arkansas, were a slave-owning tribe or slave-owning nation. So yeah, they actually owned slaves, or like, you know, had people that were captives that they forced to work. And so
was it like a warrior-based thing, or were they like chattel slavery owning?
This is something we should perhaps do a future episode on, because I'm still learning more about what that meant, because I imagine with their different conception of property than, you know, the Eurocentric white supremacist framing of what property rights are, it's probably a little bit different than like chattel slavery as we generally learn about or conceive of it.
You know what I just thought about? Like, you said, like, you, okay, so it's just okay. So whenever anyone, you know, when you're having like these conversations, right? And obviously, it's always, you got to have the caveat of, you know, I guess looking at things in the past with the lens of today and all that sort of shit. But like, whenever like motherfuckers are talking about like if you're talking with somebody who is maybe like a conservative or a Republican or racist or whatever, and they're like, oh well, you know, this group of people had slaves too, and that group of people had slaves too. And it's like, the explanation that you give when you're arguing with these people is, it's like, yeah, but it's not like
it was wrong when European that person slavery did it. Yes.
Because, you know, it wasn't race-based and shit. And then, like, you stop for a second, you think, it's like, damn, but it was slavery.
It was still slavery, and it was very wrong that they did that. And so what does that mean for, like, we talk about reparations, we talk about when there's, you know, increasing discussion of reparations for both indigenous and African descendants of slaves, but like, you know, so it, you know, that knowledge of that history, it does complicate those conversations in a way that I do hope that folks can like productively work through, because yeah, we gotta, you know, we're never gonna, well, I don't want to say never, it's not something that's gonna get resolved, you know, shortly.
Well, part of the whole, you know, I think part of the most important step to the project of reparations, I guess, would be having as many people be informed of the past as it really happened.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean? So that you can get that sort of, you know, just general social understanding that, you know, these wrongs were committed and need to be righted and all that sort of stuff. You'd be shocked at how many people, well, you probably wouldn't be shocked, you're an educator, you probably know better than I do. Motherfuckers don't know a lot of stuff.
Nah, man.
Like the, you know, when the Jimmy Kimmel does the thing where they ask people the questions in the street and shit. Uh-huh. Yeah, like that's just like indicative of a lot more than we would want to think.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. So what's been going on in the news today?
Oh boy.
I got a couple stories pulled up. You got anything?
I'm excited to talk about the things that you pulled. Oh, yeah. Things that have also been on my mind. But yeah, what's on yours this week?
Okay, well, going from the most important to the least important, I guess, are the two things I got. So there has been a new kid on the block in terms of COVID strains. The
new kid on the block. The, dark, bro.
How do you pronounce it? Omicron? I feel like I gotta say it. Like
Omicron.
Omicron. Like
I don't know. I just do it in a robot Omicron voice every time. Yeah. The new Avengers movie.
The Omicron strain that the white man is saying started in South Africa.
Bruh, they now know that, yeah, this is such fuckery and ridiculousness. But they now have confirmation that it originated in Europe or it was in Europe way before they realized. They were just identified in fucking South Africa, and the whole of the South African portion of the continent had to suffer as a result. Yeah. Whack shit. Unsurprising, but whack.
I'm surprised that they didn't, like, just straight up try some shit like that from the very beginning. Like, yeah.
They were probably, like, jumping and waving their hands and waving flags and smoke signals like, bruh. We're not saying it came from here. We're just the fucking, as I mentioned in our interview that's coming up, we're just the best epidemiologists in the world because of the HIV/AIDS epidemic. Like, we just happen to have found this first because we're fucking sick with it, with our scientific skills. But no.
And literally sick with it. Like, niggas is coughing.
But nah, man. Yeah, I mean, I feel like the, like, Western media was... It was always eager to jump on. You know, it's funny that Trump got so lambasted for that, like, shithole country comment. He was just saying what a lot of people were thinking. You know what I mean? Excuse me. You know what I mean? Like, in policy, like, policymaking, they might not say it out loud, but it's, like, indicating a similar orientation towards this whole fucking continent.
Yeah, I think that's, like, the... That is, like, the brand of the Republicans now. You heard about that shit with Lauren Boebert and the Islamophobic
shit. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's, like, shit like that. Like, it doesn't matter what punishment that they do to her or whatever as far as in the
house. She don't fundraise like a motherfucker.
Hell yeah, because, like, all of her voters are they're with the shits.
Like, and they're like, all... oh, the liberals are trying to silence me. Can you give $5 today?
If you watch that tape, like, people in the room were laughing. You know what I'm saying? And first it was like nervously so, but then once they look around, it's like, oh yeah, no, yeah, we're all pieces of shit in here. Okay, it's safe. And then her voters are with that shit. And Republican voters are with that. So you're absolutely right. When Trump says something like shithole countries, it's not some gasping thing like, I can't believe he said that. Because in honesty, fucking... At least 70 million people in America think that way too.
And what it to me conjures is that if that's what they're willing to say in public, what are they saying in private? Like, it's deeply concerning. Like, that scares the shit out of me. Oh. Like, imagine what their private conversations are like.
Why do you think Trump doesn't want them to get the records? I know people think it's for the January 6th shit, but I think it's more than that. I think if they get the White House records of the Trump years, it's going to be more N-words than the new 2 Chainz album, yo.
Yeah. Whoo. Dark times. But rays of sunshine, what happened to Chris Cuomo?
Oh, word. Okay, so yeah, that was in the unimportant half, I guess. Chris Cuomo was suspended indefinitely by CNN for trying to help his brother in the midst of his sexual harassment allegations. Now,
which I just feel like...
I'm going to keep it real with you folks. Yeah. I don't know exactly how he helped his brother in doing this.
He, like, when he was getting, like, sources for news stories, he was, like, letting his brother know, like, yo, this person said this.
And this nigga was out in sources?
Yeah, like, damn. Oh, this person said this about you. And stuff like that. Yeah. And then also the other way around, like, coordinating, I believe, like, spin. Like, hey, you'd like trying to pretty, like, what we knew what was going on the whole time, to be frank, is that he was covering for him in their reporting.
There's stuff that you would expect. You know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, there was a natural, like, at least for me, I mean, I don't really watch Chris Cuomo or follow it, but just knowing that they're brothers and one's a journalist and one's a politician, for me, there's just, like, you know, there's, like, a built-in amount of corruption.
Automatic corruption.
So it's like, for me, there's just, like, a big, okay, the dude's probably gonna help his brother or shill for his brother.
And you,
like,
know, CNN knew that. Yeah. And so what's happening to Chris Cuomo now?
They probably
should
have just suspended him. Even without malice, but they probably should have at least taken him off the air until the
taking him off the you can't report on this. Yeah, whatever. Anyway,
it's like, I mean, you can pick any journalist you want, but, like, I know Anderson Cooper's family is, like, you know, they're rich and famous and shit, and it's like, yeah, if, like, something happened with Anderson Cooper's family, you would just expect that the dude's coverage would now be compromised,
right?
Even if he's got the integrity to be like, no, I'm not going to help my family. I'm not going to blah, blah. I'm going to call it down the middle. As the employer, you've got to make that executive decision to be like, all right, nigga, why don't you sit back until this shit is done? Go collect your check, and we're just gonna take.
They make the decision to hold these people accountable when they get caught as being complicit in the corruption by like, this is probably going on. We're not gonna say anything because, you know, people love this anchor, but yeah. I suspect this is probably going on. I was like, whoopsie daisy, we got caught not censoring them or not like holding them accountable. So now we got to cover our own ass.
Yeah, but I mean even with that though, I mean, it's like, that's outing sources and shit is not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about more like underhanded shit, you know what I mean? Like, I'll give favorable coverage or I'll cover the story in this way. That's the sort of shit that I would expect. But if motherfuckers is like, yo, such and such is writing this about you, yo, such and such is came to the CNN offices to drop it. Like, if you're out in sources and shit, that's a step away from mafia shit, yo. Like, you know what I mean? If the Trump administration was doing that, I would be all over him. So fuck these dudes with that shit.
But I did call it a little ray of sunshine because at least there's some accountability, because generally when there's just media malfeasance, nothing happens. No one should ever be able to
get another journalism job. If that's the case, though.
Motherfucker's gonna start a Substack and get a bunch of subscribers who love his chiseled jaw.
He's gonna post up your OnlyFans workout and shit. You know what I mean? Like, do you?
Yo, okay, legit, I would probably subscribe to that. Cause it's not unethical, cause it's no longer, you know. But yeah, no, he shouldn't do journalism anymore.
All right, so what do we got going on today?
So we opened talking about Omicron and this continuing crisis of public health that we are still facing, as well as public policy in reaction to public health challenges, you know, with the travel ban on South African countries, et cetera. So I thought it was appropriate this week to speak with a public health practitioner. So we're going to talk a little bit about what public health is, how it manifests in like practice in local context, and a little bit of just like hip hop, obviously, because you tuned in to Way No Reparations. So let's get on into it. This is DeMonte Dismuke.
We'll be right back with that after the jump.
All right. So today I am here with DeMonte Dismuke, host of a dope public health podcast, which I had the pleasure of joining a couple weeks ago. DeMonte, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Doing fabulous, except for, you know, having a slight little cold today. But speaking of, you know, being sick, I feel like with coronavirus pandemic, which I don't think I have a Rona, but, you know, thinking about things like viruses and things like that, you know, the pandemic has brought public health into mainstream conversation in a way that I don't think has ever been true before in our lifetimes, but still folks may have a limited scope of understanding about what public health can mean. So I wondered if you could tell us what public health is to you and describe your own public health practice.
Sure, absolutely. So like, to me, like in a nutshell, public health, the way I describe it to people is like, okay, well, just think about you as an individual and all the things that make you you. So whether that be your physical health, your environment, all those things. So basically, so like if we start from an individual, then we go up in the air like in a drone, then we get to looking at society as a whole. So now it's how are all of these people doing, and how do these behaviors dictate how we're moving throughout society? And do we need to encourage certain things to help people make healthier decisions, or do we need to, you know, encourage certain type of behavior? So in a nutshell, basically public health is just that overall, how are we doing as a people?
Yeah. So I think that gives us a good foundation for what public health can mean. But could you talk a little bit about your own practice as a public health practitioner?
Sure, absolutely. So what I do for a living, in addition to my podcast, is I oversee a program for youth ages 18 to 21, that age out of foster care. So you're like, okay, My program runs off of what we call five pillars of stability. The organization that I work for is WellPoint Care Network, formerly known as St. A. So essentially our five pillars of stability are housing, education, employment, caring connections, and health. If all of those things are addressed with the youth that we serve, then they have a more optimal opportunity to live a healthier life. And because they aged out of the foster care system, you know, this program exists to allow folks to just try to level that playing field. So there's just certain things like tuition scholarships that are available. There's something we call the Brighter Star Scholarship, and folks can get $5,000 toward their education, housing assistance up to $300 a month. So we are literally hitting all of those different things. And the five pillars of stability pretty much mirror, you know, the World Health Organization's social determinants of health.
Yeah, that's what I got thinking about. When we talk about like a healthy future, I think that particularly, well, for me and other folks that have become, who have had their consciousness raised through last summer's uprising, starting to think about, and the pandemic as well, starting to think about health in a broader way. Like you brought up housing, and you housing, and we heard the refrain a lot, like housing is healthier, because you can't shelter in place if you don't have a place to go and things like that. So I wonder when you talk about a healthier future, are you looking specifically at like physical health indices, or does that extend to like behavioral, or is it
absolutely
even broader than that, and thinking about just like health, like healthier life outcomes in terms of self-actualization?
Yes, it's actually, yes, the big picture of just healthier life outcomes. And that's kind of like, you know, you look at, you know, sometimes we collaborate with other countries and we try to do things like alleviating diseases. So like, if you think about it, certain things that we have, you know, that were popular when we were younger are just no longer a thing due to the advances of medicine. So, but then broadening that scope to make sure that, okay, well, can we make a healthier planet? So, you know, but it's all broken down to, you know, whomever is in leadership in that particular location.
Mm-hmm. And so what has your interaction been with, I guess, the leaders in your location around issues of public health? Do you find that your representatives at the state or local level are being responsive to what your understanding and your the needs that you've identified through your work about how we can approach public health, both in like a physical health understanding, but a broader understanding as well?
Yeah. So, and that's a great question. And I think I just so happen to be in the right place at the time.
You're in Milwaukee, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yep. I'm located in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And, you know, so I collaborate with the Department of Children and Families, which is more like a governmental issue. I mean, entity. But, you know, and that's how I'm able to oversee my program. But then we have, you know, county supervisor, you know, like David Crowley, who, you know.
Oh, yeah, I know David. Yeah.
So I facilitated a public health panel back in August. And it was so cool having him on the panel, because when he's talking, he literally, within the first 60 seconds, he mentioned social determinants of health. So having amazing leaders like him leading the charge, I feel like I'm in the right place at the right time, because he hears what, you know, what's needed in the community.
That's good to hear, because as in my role as an elected official here on the local level, when I bring up, as we spoke about on your podcast, I believe, the fact that like the CDC has now identified gun violence as a public health crisis, a public health issue, or when I bring up, you know, youth development then as an avenue to improve public health outcomes by ending gun violence. So some of my peers, particularly like older folks, perhaps more moderate folks, it can sound like, well, you're just twisting, you know, science or whatever to match your beliefs. When really it sounds like, you know, like in the world of public health, as my, you know, as I understand it, as someone that doesn't practice but does interpret public health understandings and findings to inform my work, that this is actually more like, you know, the state of the field at this point of looking at these social determinants of health. And so we definitely, as a country and then many localities, have faced struggles with mashing what we understand from science and what we understand from experts to our actual practice as in governance. And so I'm happy to hear that in your setting, you found a lot of help, a lot of positive interactions with the folks that are making those decisions for the community.
Yeah, and I mean, and we have an uphill battle. I mean, and I'm doing everything that I can, so which is why I wanted to start my podcast. But it's also too, you know, there's a lot of different things going on, in, for example, in the city of Milwaukee, that we need to address these things on a public health level. And like, you know, I'm sure you've heard, you know, with your practice, like, there's this push, not in just Wisconsin, but throughout the country, evidence-based policy. So it's like, you know, like you said, folks can say you're twisting it, but if you look at the data and look at the research, it's evidence-based.
Yeah, and it's so hard to get people, it's surprisingly difficult to get people to like consider evidence-based practices. Like there's so many practices that are just ingrained in us either through the media or it's just what we grew up with. And so that's what we, you know, what we expect and what we push forward, this continuation of stuff that just like doesn't have any sort of scientific backing. I think it's true of many kinds of government, both local and even at the federal level, that people really struggle, you know, even, you know, Democrats sometimes say like, oh, we believe in science, but like, what science? Like y'all, yeah. You know, and how is that actually impacting, the decisions you make at times. Not everybody is always like up with it or just like, you know, engaging with like the data and like.
Yeah. Wow. Like that. And that's such a great point, because when you think about, you know, the last roughly 2 years now with what we've been going through with this pandemic, you can, so different governments are making different decisions in regards to, you know, lockdown and this or that. And when you look at it from a public health lens, it's like those leaders are making decisions based on evidence as opposed to based on emotion or economy. And it's really interesting when you can just take a step back and look, oh, wow, they made that decision and they were able to, you know, alleviate this, you know, the severity of the virus in that area versus this group is really like, well, to hell with it, we're gonna do our thing. So it's just very, very interesting. And that's literally all public health, because we're trying to push towards, you know, a healthier community so we can all truly go back outside.
Yeah, and so this actually makes me think of like what's going on right now with like the Omicron variant of coronavirus, that we've imposed this lockdown, this travel ban from all these South African countries, despite the fact that the variant's been found in Israel and Belgium and Ireland and many white Western countries. And so in the name of public health, you know, we're making decisions that perhaps are actually more informed by emotion or even some racial animus more so than facts about like, you know, what is actually a threat to the health of our communities at times.
Absolutely. And you know, like you know, the information I've been able to get my hands on thus far, it's so new that it's just like, well, everybody's learning. And you know, but some of the things that like the scientists are saying already is just that this probably is everywhere already.
Right.
But
right.
Now we've identified it.
Right. And it was like, identified in South Africa because they have the best epidemiologists in the world because of the AIDS and HIV epidemic, is my understanding. And so they were able to track it down, even though it's probably everywhere already.
Yeah. And it's just like you said, it's some people are making decisions based on emotion. Others are making it based on science.
Yeah. Well, we talked go for it.
And the last thing I'll add is just like when you think about certain things, it's just it makes you kind of think like, well, there's a lot of other things that we're deciding and we're, you know, doing because of our personal interests as well. So it's like, yeah, it's a tough spot.
Yeah, for sure. We talked a lot about the science of public health, but the World Health Organization also defines public health as the art and science of preventing disease, prolonging life, and promoting health through the organized efforts of society. So I've been increasingly like, you know, looking at the data, looking at evidence-based practices, trying to inform my governance and policymaking. But I'm interested in this idea of public health being an art. Do you see that in your practice at all? Or your understanding of public health? And if so, where and how?
I see it as an art because I don't think that there is you know, it's just so tough as far as perfection. Like, you know, we could come to solutions a lot of different ways. And like kind of having that artist background is like just getting people to understand. It's more like it's trying to convey that information. And I just truly believe that that's an art form, you know, just trying to inform and help, you know, shape and mold behaviors with honesty and like, you know, truly with the people's best interest. I think that that's an art form.
For sure. I mean, it makes sense to me that if a part of the effort is promoting health, that then is an act of communication, of communicating to people, you know, what will keep them healthy and what will keep them safe, which, you know, language is an art form, you know, communicating effectively is an art form to a certain extent. So that makes a lot of sense to me. But I'm glad that we kind of shifted to talking about the arts, because you have somewhat of an artistic background as well. Is that right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Talk to us a little bit about that.
So I really am a student of, and I even tell my kids, I'm like, I'm part of the first generation of hip hop. I wear that proudly. And hip hop has influenced everything that I do. How I lead, how I, you know, fellowship, it's all in this, you know, under this umbrella of hip hop. And I just think about the power of hip hop. You know, there are other entities and organizations that have done some amazing things in creating social change, but hip hop is up there as well.
Yeah. So talk to me about the role you see hip hop playing in making systemic change.
Yeah, I think it's maybe because I was born into it, it seems like it's always been there. Mm-hmm. I think what we're seeing less and less of is maybe folks in the mainstream talking about things, but then we have, you know, people like Kendrick Lamar who are very, you know, they're informing, as is J. Cole. But I go back to like groups like Boogie Down Productions, MCs like KRS-One, Common, and, you know, so many, Public Enemy, where they had this, they were conveying the stories of their neighborhood, which basically is conveying the stories of the conditions in which they live in. That's public health. That's public health all day. So, and I think that's where I think, look at it as an art form.
For sure. Yeah. There's that consciousness raising aspect to it that I think is an important precursor.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I don't think it's every artist's responsibility to do that. But I always feel that there's always the right ones that are doing it that can help galvanize change. So it just seems like it's just this responsibility that, you know, every 10 plus years or so, MCs pass that torch, and it's always woven in within hip hop.
Are you talking about being born into hip hop, particularly being in the first generation of hip hop? Because now we've had several, you know, there's you know, the second generation, I guess probably on third or fourth at this point. Hip hop's been around for what, 50 years?
Yeah.
So what do you think? So what to you does being born into hip hop as like a first generation hip hopper mean? Or what was that for you?
To me, it's everything, because growing up African-American, like I don't, you know, I can do the 23andMe and it says like, oh wow, like you're 30 something percent Nigerian, but it's like, but I don't have that direct connection to my Nigerian ancestry. So like, and then I can look at other folks and you can see, oh wow, that's you can see that culture. Hip hop was the first culture I was able to see and be a part of, and it's actually mine, not one that was like that we had to assimilate to.
Yeah, that's powerful. That's powerful. In watching successive generations who are themselves also born into hip hop, but maybe taking it up in new ways, what has that been like for you?
I think it's been amazing, because some of the things that I've been seeing with some of the younger artists have been blowing my mind. And I mean that in a great way. And what I say by that is, so for example, an artist like Cordae, or also when you think about Essence, just had like multiple covers Simone Biles and Naomi, and it was, they're calling it radical self-care. Mm-hmm. And to me, I'm like, they, not only do they get it, they're so open with their expression of being their best selves. So I find it to be amazing with the newer artists today.
Yeah, I definitely think we're becoming a more inclusive community, though, by, you know, steps forward and steps back with the kinds of truths that people are able to express in their music. Whereas previous generations may have had, you know, struggles with coherently deeply tackling things like depression or homosexuality. Yes. And things like that, for sure. Yes. But it's interesting you bring up self-care. I would be really interested to hear your perspective as a public health practitioner about self-care is becoming increasingly mainstream. And yeah. I think at times co-opted by corporatist yes. forces. It's like, oh, self-care is buying mm-hmm. this bath bomb, or you have to take this expensive ski trip to Aspen, and things like that. So where do you see self-care fitting into your practice, or, you know, what you try to instill in your in the populations you work with? And what are you sure. think some of the barriers that people face sure. that you work with as well?
I would say I think it's so important in it. And like I was facilitating my first conference, I think back in September, and I went around the room and I asked people about self-care, and one person gave the most honest answer. She was like, I'm still trying to figure it out and get it. I don't really understand it yet. I know what I'm supposed to say. And it, to me, that was just so powerful, because I'm like, it has become this cliche thing. So I'm trying to take the cliche away from it. It's one of the things that we discuss in our meetings all the time. And now I just say with my team, are you doing what you said you were going to do to take care of yourself? Mm. So that's kind of like, you know, how I go about leading. And the second part of your question again?
I think the second part, barriers that people face, I think you started to touch on that, where you encounter yeah. clients or populations you work with that people yeah. just don't even know how to begin to confront that question of what they need and how they get there.
And I agree with that, because when you the barriers for like the youth that I serve would be, you know, internet connectivity could help self-care. But I don't live in an area that has Wi-Fi, nor can I afford it. So we say these self-care things, but music is my thing. So this is how I self-soothe. I listen to music. Well, these are some of the barriers that folks that, you know, young youth that I serve, they're faced with when they tell me, DeMonte, they give me the real. So that allows me to do what we can to try to help. Like, you know, now, for example, I think it was recently released, like Oprah donated, I forget the exact dollar amount, I think $20,000 or something to our organization. Wow. Just to make sure youth had access to things like Wi-Fi throughout the pandemic.
Yeah, wow. I mean, that's so interesting, the ways that we think about, particularly the issue of internet access is impacting education, ability for people to get jobs. But I didn't even think about the fact that, like, I probably know about self-care because of the internet, of seeing tweets about it or seeing something on Instagram, let alone like being able to get on Spotify and listen to my favorite music on a walk or something like that as a way to undertake self-care, and the ways that could serve as a barrier also.
Absolutely, because there's yeah. all these meditation apps and things like that.
Meditation apps, yeah.
Yeah.
I listen to like bird sounds when I go to sleep at night because I have Wi-Fi in my house.
Yes.
You know, stuff like that for sure. So getting back to, you know, public health, particularly the WHO definition we discussed earlier, they talk about public health as the organized efforts of society, which to mm-hmm. me sounds like they're talking about collaboration in a sense. And if you think, absolutely. For example, an example that I think is readily accessible to all of us during the pandemic, we talked about early on flattening the curve by wearing masks, social distancing, and the like. They were meant to be collaborative efforts, like I protect you and you protect me, but we seem mm-hmm. to struggle with that as a society. So can you talk to us about the power of collaboration, both in public health and in community service more broadly?
Yeah, because to me, they go hand in hand. I think, you know, when we were talking about different communities making different decisions for their society, which helped, you know, help them flatten the curve faster than a country such as the United States. Meanwhile, there was a lot of back and forth with, you know, a lot of people that made big decisions about how do we collaborate. So, you know, I just think it's just so important that, like, collaboration is everything, because we have, like we were talking about, evidence-based practices, right? But if you're not really working with communities that need these things met, how evidence-based is that research? So to help society get better, you know, I understand that researchers make the big bucks, and, you know, other folks that fall under this, epidemiologists and all, and things like that. However, the people in the communities in which we are trying to serve are also just as important. So if we don't collaborate, then we'll continue to have this power struggle and this authoritative view on public health. And it's like, yeah, I understand you're smart, but let me teach you how my people roll. For example, I mean, being Black is so many things that I ate growing up that, like, and now, like, I eat a primarily plant-based diet. And it's like, that was a cultural shift for my family. So I feel like collaboration is, like, the number one thing that will help really advance this field.
Yeah, and I love that you brought up, you know, collaboration with communities between scientists and researchers and, like, the folks living in, you know, living the impacts of public policy, the impacts of organized efforts of society to advance health. Particularly resonates with my own experience as a scholar that, you know, I'm out here as a community organizer, I'm working in community centers, going to cookouts, all this stuff. And as a PhD student, I have a lot of my colleagues that want to do community-based research, but just don't have the connections. So they come to me like, oh, how do we get in? Like, how do we recruit people to do this or that study? But there's such resistance, particularly in, you know, African-American communities, because of the ways that science has been sort of, like, harvested from these communities without anything given back. Like, oh, we got this data. Or, you know, you look at even an example like the story of, like, Henrietta Lacks, where, like, her cells were just taken and used for research and, you know, without her permission, et cetera, et cetera. Absolutely. All this history of science sort of being very extractive and exploitative. People don't trust you when you show up to say, hey, we're trying to do this study or that study. Do you think the field of public health is reckoning with this adequately at this point in time?
Honestly, I feel like it's too early to say. I know, like, back in 2018, you know, Wisconsin, you know, here, the Public Health Association, they declared racism a public health crisis. You know, however, it just seems it's so tough to say, because it's like, well, we need more public health practitioners that look like us. So I think, you know, I think the jury is out on that, because, you know, throughout the last 2 years, how many times have we heard folks' response? They just say Tuskegee. But I know people that look like us that are researchers now.
Yeah, I've heard oftentimes that, like, the visibility of scientists that are doing this work could be helpful in smashing some of that stigma. But the jury is still out. I think those relationships take a really long time to form, and that history takes a long time to absolve or be absolved. So we hopefully we'll see, you know, if these changes are happening quickly enough in this particular field that I think holds a lot of power. I should have asked you this at the beginning, but perhaps I will now ask you this to close out. How did you get into public health in the first place?
I think I just kind of fell into it. You know, I'm a mental health guy, love mental health, excuse me. But then I was like, I was working with youth, working with mental health. But then it was like, there was a disconnect. And part of the disconnect was therapists didn't look like the kids that we served. And as I got promoted, the young men that I work with, I started to see less and less of an impact. But I thought, well, if I can get promoted, I can help more young men that look like me. So long story short, I ended up seeing that, you know, it's got to be something bigger. So I end up, my degree is on hold right now, but I've taken like 6-7 MPH classes.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially that's what our society needs. And I just so happened to be overseeing this program where I got a promotion and I now oversee this program for youth to age out. And I just feel like it was a destiny kind of thing because, you know, these social determinants of health, I work with them every day with one of the most vulnerable populations, you know, in my city.
Mm-hmm. Earlier, you said something that I thought was interesting. You love mental health, which I think is like sort of, I mean, makes sense. Who wouldn't? Mental health is really important. But how did you get to that point of loving mental health?
I think it became with, one of the things that I experienced is I was going to school for human resources and I was working as a recruiter. And I talked about this on like one of my first podcasts, but like, I didn't like how I was being treated by cops when I was driving out to the suburbs.
Yeah.
So I literally switched my major from human resources to human services management. Hmm. And when I got my degree, I got my first job as a care coordinator for an entity called Wraparound Milwaukee. And it was just like, I was able to help young people make better outcomes and normalize these different feelings and these different emotions. You know, now it's kind of like, it's more publicly acceptable. But back when I started in like 2008, not many Black men in the community were even talking about mental health. So I think that's what made me fall in love with it, because I'm like, well, if I can be one of the people in my city talking about this and trying to do right by my community, like, I mean, it resonated with me because I feel like I'm one of those people that, I try to normalize like things like therapy.
Mm-hmm. We had a recent episode on mental health and how it's addressed in hip hop, and we discussed some of the structural barriers to accessing mental health support, you know, our system of insurance and shortage of doctors, therapists, both of color, but just in the field more broadly because of, it's just not the most lucrative kind of doctor you can be. Where do you think some of the other, what do you think are some of the other barriers to accessing mental health support, including cultural stigmas in the community? Where does all that come from?
Yeah, I think it's a lot of the issue with the barriers is just because, you know, again, can I trust this person who's so supposedly an expert?
That's something I don't think we got to. But yeah, just trusting is like really difficult.
So, you know, and I think, you know, if you look at the stats, like the last time I looked, African-American people seek therapy, like maybe like 1/3 of the amount of folks that are white. And it's just because culturally we've just been raised to tough it out or mm-hmm. pray through it, not knowing that there could have been some schizophrenia in play, which mm-hmm. is why Uncle so-and-so behaved that way. So I think it's really, really opening up the eyes to us as an African-American community so we can begin to take that healing another step.
For sure. Yeah, that trust is really important and like hard to build for sure. And the distrust is warranted, again, based on just the history of health and science and Black people in this country. We do have this culture of, and this is something we also somehow didn't touch on in that episode, of just like being hard is valued. It's being really tough and being able to weather it all is valorized. And I think that also extends to broader culture as well. I mean, I think just like in a capitalist society, you're supposed to just work and and expend yourself limitlessly just because that's what we're expected to do, but particularly so in Black communities. And that then gives rise, I guess, to, you know, gun violence, organized crime, interpersonal, you know, and domestic violence, things like that, which themselves are additional public health issues. People are showing up at the ER with gunshot wounds, or, you know, dealing with toxic stress from living in an abusive household, things like that.
Yeah, and I think it's one of those things that, like, part of my, you know, one of my roles is I used to have to go to court because I work with young men that were adjudicated, you know, something happened and they got charged. But then convincing the judges that were making decisions that keep feeding this pipeline to prison was an uphill battle, because going in front of the judge saying, no, it's actually because of this diagnosis. These are some behaviors that align with that. However, with these supportive services, we can help this young Black man, as in, like, instead of you sending him away.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, that's all the questions I had. Is there anything else that we didn't touch on that you want to talk about?
No, I just really appreciate the collaboration, just in the spirit of it. I mean, being able to kind of catch you doing your thing when you presented, you know, at a summit on poverty in Milwaukee, you know, that right there, just seeing, I'm like, wow, it's a good feeling to see that there are other people fighting this good fight. So, you know, just I appreciate you and extending that hand in collaboration, because if we can continue to inform each other, we can help our communities even more.
Amen. Amen to that. Well, thank you so much for being here. Desmonte, where can we find you and learn more about your work and your media?
Absolutely. So you can find me just a Dope Public Health Podcast, pretty much on all social media platforms. That's where you can learn about what I'm doing and how I want to amplify the voices of public health practitioners. So you can definitely find me there. You can actually, you know, listen to the podcast and provide feedback, and, you know, let's just keep this thing going and helping our communities become better and better.
Amazing. Thank you so much, man.
No problem.
Hey, we are back.
We are back, and we are closing it out today with a little preview of things to come. Next week, we're going to be talking about Dick Gregory. Mac, who is Dick Gregory? I know him because he was like a vegetarian activist, but yeah. I didn't realize he had a very storied history otherwise.
Oh, yeah. Now, Dick Gregory is a famous African-American comedian, political activist. He even ran for office a couple times. I think he ran for president, like, I think back in the 60s and shit like that as a writer.
Yeah, but so we talking a little bit about that.
Yeah, we're gonna chat about him. Don't we have an interview coming up with somebody?
Yeah, so soon we're going to have on my esteemed homie, Aaron Thorpe, who is a brilliant writer and political thinker, going to talk to us about retroism and the sense of futurelessness that drives this, like, nostalgia trend with media, with fashion, etc. The sense that, like, millennials and Gen Z feel like we don't have a fucking future. So we reach back in time to, like, you know, get the 1980s looking t-shirt or, like, watch Stranger Things and things like that, because we don't believe there's anything ahead of us. So we're going to talk a little bit about that and what it means for hip hop as well. Coming up.
Now,
very excited for that.
So
I checked Twitter and found that across the state of Georgia, progressives swept conservative incumbents out their seats en masse. And so in preparation for discussing that next week, I thought I'd break you off a little sum right now. Ha. Y'all motherfuckers thought that Georgia was Virginia, didn't ya? And that is why I've never cared for your opinion. In the wastes, we be winning when the people who have held the power look out for the renters enriching themselves and selling our communities. But who would think that we'd let them renew the seats instead of electing some freshies out the junior league? If you believe in fighting, organizing, do it dutifully, then you can lead. That's the lesson from Tuesday Eve.
Ooh. Ooh. My name's Dope Knife.
I'm Lingua Franca.
And we are waiting on reparations. Peace.
Listen to Waiting on Reparations on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.